Hello, dear listeners. Welcome to another episode of Follow Your Path. My name is Abdul Abed. I'm a surgical pathology fellow at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. And today we will be talking to Dr. Dennis Omal. He's a hematopathologist at NeoGenomics in California. And he's also an adjunct professor at MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, Texas. I'm also joined today by a junior resident at George Washington University, Zul Tariq. Welcome to the show, Dr. Omal.
Thanks so much. Appreciate you having me on.
So starting off, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, where you grew up, where you went to medical school and did your residency?
Sure. So I am originally from Southern California. I was born here. I sort of grew up in the high desert of California, which is sort of between Los Angeles and Las Vegas. I did my undergrad around this area in what's called the Inland Empire in Southern California. I did medical school in the same area. So I went to Loma Linda University here in Southern California. When I was in medical school, I did a post-sophomore pathology fellowship, which, you know, was just wonderful. Well, the best thing ever. And it convinced me I was going to go into pathology. And really, the only other thing I was considering besides pathology was going into clinical genetics. But the usual pathway to get into clinical genetics is to do pediatrics. And the one thing I didn't want to do was see sick kids all day. So I went into pathology. I'll tell you a kind of a fun story about doing post-sophomore pathology fellowship. So, you know, you stop between after your sophomore year and you go and you do basically a first year of pathology residency. That's exactly what I did. I did everything a resident did. I signed cases, did frozens. I didn't sign cases. I looked at cases and did frozens and did all the rotations and autopsies. Then I went back, my third year, and so I had to do the rest of my clinical rotations. And I did a GYN rotation at an away hospital, so nobody knew me there. And I was in GYN surgery, and they had a frozen section. And so they said, and I said, well, you want me to take it down to pathology for you? And they said, sure, take it down to pathology. So I took it down to pathology, and the pathologist was there waiting for it, and I said, well, do you want me to do the frozen section? And they looked at me kind of puzzled, like, you know, who is this guy? You know, but the guy said, sure, go ahead. So, you know, to their surprise, I stick it on there and I freeze it, cut a nice section, stain it up, hand it to them, and they put it under the scope, and they say, okay, well, what do you think? And I said, well, I think it looks like struma ovarii. And the pathologist looked at it for a second. He goes, you're right. It does look like struma ovarii. And I go, okay, thanks. So I back up, told the surgeons, you know, all good. The next day we were at a tumor board, and this pathologist comes in and he goes, what is this? There's this medical student. He comes in, he does the frozen section. He makes a diagnosis and then he leaves. It's crazy. He's medical students now. So it was really funny for me because, you know, I already had the skill set. So when I went back to my clinical rotations, it was my mind was in pathology already, and I was already thinking about, you know, it's funny because like I did the minimal number of procedures when I was a medical student because what I said to myself is, as a pathologist, I'm not going to do that, and I'd rather that my colleagues, my friends that I'm working with, who really are going to do this for a living, have more experience than I do. So you know, it's like. I delivered as many babies as I had to, and I stopped because, you know, let somebody else deliver them because they're going to deliver a baby, maybe. Not me. That's just not going to come up. But I kind of regret that now. I'd rather have better clinical skills than, you know, you wouldn't want me to do an LP on you, for example. It would be no fun. Did my residency at Loma Linda, and really... During that time, I had some really great mentors. One is kind of a guy that's sort of, well, kind of famous. When you're a pathologist, you've heard his name a lot, which is Thomas Dutcher. So he's the guy that they named Dutcher bodies after. And he discovered those in lymphoplasmacytic lymphoma, Waldenstrom's. And so he was really great influence and got me interested in heme path. And that's really one of those people. And then so did that, and then I did two, count two, hematopathology fellowships. I did 1 year at Duke University, and then I did another year at a place called Carolinas Medical Center. It's in Charlotte with a very well-known hematopathologist called Peter Banks. And so I was going specifically to do lower lymph node pathology with Dr. Banks.
Oh, wonderful. That's great to know. I was going to ask you about any mentors, and you already answered that. So that's wonderful.
Yeah, both Dr. Dutcher and Dr. Banks were very strong influences on my career. Dr. Dutcher was he was a bit of a curmudgeon. He would sort of grunt at us and kind of be very impatient, and if we didn't know answers, he would get kind of annoyed with us. So there was sort of a fair amount of competition to get smarter faster, so you didn't get grunted at. Dr. Banks is very different, and in the way that, and I think that this is something that, if you're lucky, you can find somebody like this. Is Peter is what I would call very intellectually generous. He really wanted you to learn, wanted you to have a good experience learning, and worked very hard to give you opportunities that would advance you. And I mean, particularly, like, I mean, something as simple as if we were at a meeting together, he would introduce me to a lot of people that he knew who were well known in the field, but that helped me build a real network of friends and colleagues. And again, I think if you're looking for a career that is broad-based, and I mean, not everybody wants a bigger career. Some people, they have just want a simple life, work at a community hospital or community practice, and keep it simple. That's cool. That's great. But I was sort of inclined towards a academic or academic-like career, and so it was good to get all those contacts and know those people.
Oh, wonderful. So in your if you had to talk to a medical student or a junior resident who has just started their residency and you wanted to tell them why they should consider hematopathology as a career, what would you tell them?
Let's say stop. Don't. No, I'm too busy. I want all the cases for myself. No, that's a great question. Look, hematopathology is one of those areas that, first of all, there are a lot of people that train in hematopathology. That's kind of interesting to me. And there's a fair amount of work in hematopathology too, but something that's kind of a challenge is there's a lot more people trained in heme path that don't do heme path full time. So I do heme path full time. That's consumes all my time, but they're, those kind of jobs are not necessarily all that common. But let me tell you about heme path and what's great about it. So I'll start by picking on surgical pathology. And I mean that in the kindest possible way. But surgical pathology, you have to know everything. Every organ system, all of them, really well. And even when you don't know it really well, you have to know enough to know when you don't know what you don't know and give it to a subspecialist. So to me, I looked at search path and it's just like too much. It was too much to handle. When I learned about heme path, what I learned is that I thought at the time I could probably get my hands around it, but I think I probably could. I'm not going to say master everything, that's not fair to say, but that I could get a good handle on everything that was there. If within hematopathology, then there's sort of smaller areas, things like, first of all, bone marrow pathology, okay, and then there's lymph node pathology. I have my super rare one, which is spleen pathology. I also do things like cutaneous heme path. You can also split between adult and pediatric. And then there's a lot of technologies that fall into the world of hemopath that are, you know, pretty common. So like flow cytometry is an area that you can sort of focus on. We also, even more than most other disciplines, we tend to do ancillary studies. So immunohistochemistry, which of course you had my pal Andrew Bellizzi on recently. But also, you know, we're doing molecular testing, we're doing PCR, we're doing FISH, we're doing NGS. So, you know, when I look now and see all the things that I did, I mean, it's certainly to me, not that other subspecialties don't use a lot of ancillary tests, but HemePath allows me to also have, you know, understanding and knowledge and do work in those other areas too, in addition to just the tissues that I see. So it's really kind of exciting. It's varied, and so it allows you to sort of be pretty broad but also pretty deep.
Yeah, wonderful.
Hi, Dr. O'Malley. Thank you so much for your time today. And speaking of, you know, keeping cases to yourself before, can you share a case that you found interesting in your career and that has stayed with you?
Gosh. Well, I'll tell you about a case I had today, because it's interesting, and it's something that, you know, this, I'm going to say, didn't really exist when I was a trainee. Is I signed out a case of a breast implant-associated anaplastic large cell lymphoma. So, first of all, you know, it's not a common thing, but the idea is that there is this lymphoma that develops in association with breast implants. We didn't know that before. It's unusual. It's generally associated with an excellent prognosis, but it can occasionally be very aggressive, and it depends on how advanced the disease is. But the thing is something that, again, as a medical student, I perhaps wouldn't have appreciated until later now when I have sort of some more advanced knowledge, is that the pathobiology that underlies a lot of these things. So, you know, how does it happen? Why? Why would we, you know, why is there this funny T-cell lymphoma that occurs there? Well, and it turns out that it's also, they've found a case that has been a case reported that's associated with a buttock implant. Granted, that's more of, I think, a South American thing. But anyway, but the idea is that this lymphoma probably arises out of chronic inflammation. And as a consequence, you know, you annoy your immune system enough, you give it that same bothersome annoyance of whatever it is, whether it's an infection in your stomach, Helicobacter, or it's the physical shearing force of the textured capsule of this breast implant, your immune system eventually responds. But then, if it continues and continues and continues, once in a while, you get what's called clonal escape, where you get one of those guys that goes bad, and they develop into a disease like lymphoma. And so, although super rare, again, this is a lymphoma that's associated with a pretty reasonably well understood pathophysiology. So, kind of cool.
Yeah, wonderful. I remember when I was doing an observership at MD Anderson, they have like a huge collection of these implant associated ALCLs, and they have a large collection, and because it was so fascinating, and they wanted to publish, which they eventually did. A huge case study on that. So that is definitely a fascinating new thing. As your job as a hematopathologist, what do you find is the most gratifying aspect of your job?
Well, I mean, first of all, I think something all pathologists internalize this at some point, but is, you know, we don't give people cancer. And that the best possible thing that you can do is be enthusiastic and excited about your work. Giving the patient the best diagnosis is the only way to give them a chance to potentially, you know, to get treated correctly. So you know, there's people that say, oh, how can you do that? It must be very depressing to see all these bad cancers. And the answer is no. Again, these people don't have any chance if you get it wrong. And the other thing that I like to, but I like to say, I really like to diagnose benign things that people were suspecting something malignant. That makes me feel really great because, you know, I mean, I think that there's probably nothing more reassuring as a patient to say, it's not this bad thing that we thought it was. But I also like to remind people, you know, you don't want to misdiagnose benign things as malignant because, you know, if you have something benign and you get chemotherapy for it, chances are, well, it's going to cure it, but, you know, there's also some bad outcomes too. Mm-hmm. So I'm always worried about the idea of overdiagnosing something, but also underdiagnosing too.
Yeah, it's definitely a huge responsibility, you know, calling something benign when it's malignant and vice versa. So for our medical students and junior residents, do you think you could briefly highlight what the training is like for hematopathology? I know you talked about your fellowships, but do you think you could just go over that a bit more?
Sure, you bet. So, you know, as a resident, you're going to probably do rotations in the field of heme path. So you get a sense of what the day-to-day is, which is that, you know, you're probably going to be looking, you know, depending on your service, you're probably going to be looking at bone marrow biopsies. You're going to be looking at lymph node or other tissue samples that might have lymphoma in them. Frequently, there's a component where you're going to do peripheral blood smear reviews of laboratory, flagged laboratory peripheral bloods. And in most of the rotations that I've seen and programs I've seen around the heme paths also do some of the body fluids as opposed to cytopathology. So those are some of the things. The training is typically, it's required to have 1 year of training. During that 1 year, again, you're probably going to have rotations. And you know, it depends on the specific place that you are, there might be a bone marrow service that's separate from a lymph node service, that's separate from a flow cytometry service, so all those things might be components. You go to a big place like MD Anderson, they have they have enough volume that they just have a service for CLL. Mm. You know, so you know, I guess I'd say when you look at hematopathology, you know, one of the things that I think is important to consider is the volume of cases, because the problem, this is my something I've sort of internalized over the years, is that in a 1 year training program, unless you have a pretty high volume, you may not even see certain kinds of things at all. Hmm. You know, if you have 300 lymph nodes a year and you see all of them, which you probably aren't going to because you'll be on some other rotations, you know, what are the chances you're going to see a rare T-cell lymphoma? T-cell lymphomas make up about 10% of all lymphomas. You know, the rare ones are 1% of that 10%, which puts you, you know, the chances of seeing, you know, one in a series of 300 cases is pretty low. And is just seeing one enough? You know, I mean, there's Bharat Nathwani, he's a well-known hematopathologist. One of the things he used to say is, you have to see something 100 times before you can recognize it. So the idea, again, of seeing one of these rare lymphomas, and again, if you only saw one, you know, you're going to be ready to diagnose that the next time you see it, because if it's rare, that means you're probably not going to see it for a while. So, I like the idea of sort of higher volume places. Now, for me, I did 2 years because I was looking for more depth in lymphoma diagnosis. And I didn't get enough of that at Duke, I felt like. There are a lot of programs out there that they'll have a second year that's actually a research year. And, yeah, that's okay. I think that's a great idea. If you like research, you will definitely get that. But I think, again, it depends on your individual interests and sort of your long-term career goals. I think at some point, you have to decide if you're going to go into an academic or, you know, something related to an academic career, then you really do need to have some research abilities, because that's one of the cornerstones of academic jobs is being academically productive. And that means publishing.
Hmm. So if a medical student or incoming resident, if they're interested in hematopathology, what advice would you give them? Any resources that you would recommend?
Okay, well, I guess first I'd start by saying, go out and try and experience some. I mean, sit with somebody that does hematopathology. I was a inveterate reader when I was a medical student. I mean, in residency, and so I would. So I read like in 1 year. I actually had this bet that in 1 year I read, I think, 11 AFIP fascicles. Okay, and so I told my residents that when I was at Indiana, which you had mentioned, I would give them $20 for every fascicle beyond 11 that they would read in a year. Nobody ever took me up on it. So the thing is books are great. I understand that books are static. I mean, I get it. It's books maybe can go out of date very quickly, but I think that reading in the field is good. There's a lot of books out there, a lot of different authors. I have with co-authors, I have a fairly basic lymph node book, and I have a fairly basic bone marrow book, and but you wouldn't necessarily have to get mine. I think the idea is to get, and I guess I would say this too, is if you're going to get a hemopath book, they're probably best to get a lymph node book and a bone marrow book, so that they have enough depth to cover both reasonably well. Because I think that if you were just trying to get one book to cover them all, what would happen with me is I read laying down, so I would get reflux, because a book that had all that in it would be pretty big. So it's like, try and get a smaller book. there's authors I can recommend. I mean, certainly Iochim's Lymphopathology by Jeff Medeiros, excellent book. I think covers the ground really well. He also, with Roberto Miranda from MD Anderson and Joe Curry, have an Atlas of Lymphopathology. Kathy Fukar's Bone Marrow Pathology from ASCP Press is sort of one of the standards in the field. Lots of books out there. But another thing that I think, again, is a really good habit to get into is when you run into an interesting case or a new case or something that you're not familiar with, is to at least do a quick literature search and see what you can come up with. Read, even if you're just reading abstracts, I think it's important to be familiar with the literature, because again, the thing about books is they might be they're going to be biased in certain ways. Now, when you get into literature, it might be a rabbit hole. In other words, if you look up the words diffuse large B-cell lymphoma and prognosis on PubMed, what you're going to find is that there are 43,000 papers on it, and they all have different prognostic things. And 42,899 of them are not really very practical or realistic or things that are used. They're interesting literature, they're interesting research, but they're not day-to-day practice used types of things. So again, I like the idea of, even if it's a habit, but I think it's a habit that people should build, is to look into the literature and do it regularly, particularly when you're stumped or when something is new and you're not familiar with it.
We know that you really like the spleen, which is not a lot of people are spleen pathologists. So tell us a little bit of experience with spleen pathology. Like, how did you sort of like narrow it down to like spleen? You do other stuff as well, but obviously you love spleen. How did it come through, and have you like discovered any new entities there?
I've come across a few things that I think are unusual, are different, but I haven't really published them because they're super rare, and I'm not sure the literature would necessarily benefit from having another obscure benign spleen thing described. But anyway, what happened is that there was a book about spleen pathology that was by Orazzi and Nyman, Dick Nyman and Attilio Orazzi. And I had read that book and I thought it was interesting, you know, and so, you know, it was just to sort of expand out and fill in my hempath information and stuff, you know, and in theory anyway, I'll explain why it isn't true, but in theory, you know, the spleen should be a hempath organ, right? Because it's got hematopoietic stuff going on. Well, it's not exactly true, and I'll tell you why in a minute. But what happened is I got my job in Indiana, and who was there? Attilio Orazzi. And who was there before that had retired? Dick Nyman. And so as a consequence, we got a modest number of cases, but also I spent a lot of time studying them. And Nyman had a big file of cases, including research cases and study cases. And so I went through that pretty religiously and worked really hard at getting that and then getting to understand sort of what was going on. Now, back to the spleen thing. See, the thing I like to look at and consider in spleen pathology is that when you have a spleen pathology, what you're talking about is you're talking about hematopoietic pathology, but you're also talking about soft tissue pathology because it gets as many soft tissue tumors as it gets lymphomas. You're also talking about vascular pathology because it tends to get vascular neoplasms as well. And then it's a reasonably good spot if you're interested in infectious disease pathology to get infectious disease cases. So as a consequence then, the more I sort of learned about spleen, the more I got to extend myself in those other areas that are not exactly what I usually do, but they kind of overlap in enough of a way that I got to learn about. So I'd argue that there's not many people that are better at soft tissue tumors of the spleen than me. Not that there aren't, but it's, I bet you my pal Jason Hornick probably is pretty good at them, but he's a sarcoma guy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, wonderful. Thank you very much for your time, Dr. O'Malley. Zul, do you have any more questions?
No. Thank you so much for your time, Dr. O'Malley.
Well, no problem at all. I encourage anybody, if anybody is interested in a hempath career, I mean, I'm happy to, you know, you can email me and I'd be happy to at least respond. I don't know if I can't give you a job or anything like that, but I can certainly give advice for free. And if you want to reach me, my email address is Dennis, Dennis, O'Malley, O'Malley, at NeoGenomics, all one word, NeoGenomics.com.
Oh, wonderful. So I have another question just off the top of my head. So is NeoGenomics where you're working, is that more of a private practice, or is it part of like an academic center as well?
So interestingly, it's neither. It's a reference lab. So we do almost exclusively oncology. Probably 95% of what we do is oncologic stuff. And so we do that for a lot of labs, even academic labs across the country. There's certain things, certain tests we do that we just do a lot of. So like we're probably the single biggest performer of HER2 staining in the country. So HER2 for breast cancer or other cancers. We're probably the biggest lab for doing PD-L1 staining in the country. Actually in the world. I know that because I spoke to the company that actually makes the antibodies, and they said we are the world's largest consumer of PD-L1 immunohistochemistry. So the reference lab is different from a private practice job, and it's different from an academic job. Just in general, you know, if you think about an academic job, what I don't do is I don't have to do any publishing, I don't have to do any academic things. In contrast to a community job is I work for a larger group. I have a lot of technology available to me, and I get a pretty broad variety of cases, but in general, like I said, we're primarily oncology, so most of what I see is leukemias and lymphomas, and most of it you know, is malignant. There's only a handful of benign cases, and you get a lot of variety of interesting cases because oftentimes pathologists send them to me because they're difficult, and so that's how I get interesting cases.
Oh, wow, wonderful. All right, thank you very much. That's our show for today, folks. You can find Dr. O'Malley on Twitter. His Twitter handle is @HemePapGuy. And thank you very much again for listening to us. If you like the show, please like and subscribe to our channels on YouTube and Apple. And we'll be back with another episode soon.
Special thank you to our listeners. Until next time, enjoy an excerpt from an upcoming interview with Dr. Justin Bishop.
We thought, wow, it's like, what a weird coincidence to have these two things going on, unrelated, surely. And so she had done, for some reason, I don't know, she had done high-risk HPV testing on it. Which is not something that we were doing, why would we, right, on any sort of sinonasal cancer or certainly a salivary type cancer. I still don't know why it was ordered, but it was beautifully positive in both components. And so, you know, it didn't happen immediately, right? That was just the first case. But it certainly, you know, put in our mind, something's going on here, like, this is something odd. So our antenna were up, and then we got a few more cases down the road, and it all kind of developed from there. So I certainly will always remember that case, yes.